Imagine you are watching a doctor cure a terminal illness right in front of your eyes.
Okay.
Like just an absolute undeniable medical marvel. And your immediate response to witnessing this is to cross your arms. That is exactly the kind of weaponized bad faith skepticism we are looking at in today's source document.
I mean, it sounds utterly absurd when you frame it that way,
Right.
but it really perfectly captures the dynamic of someone who has already decided they aren't going to believe what they are seeing, you
Yeah.
know, regardless of the evidence presented.
Yeah, and that brings us to what we're exploring today. Welcome to the deep dive.
Yeah.
We have this fascinating document in our stack titled The Sign of Jonah.
It's a great read.
It really is. It breaks down a specific historical and textual argument from the ancient text of Matthew 12, verses 38 through 42. The narrative hook in this document is incredibly cinematic.
Oh, it sets the scene perfectly.
It does. We have the Pharisees and the teachers of the law. And for context, if you aren't familiar, these are the ultimate religious insiders of their day.
Like the absolute elite.
Right. They approach Jesus and they demand a miraculous sign to prove his authority.
Which you have to realize is a demand for a highly specific type of empirical validation.
Yeah.
They're essentially saying, perform on our exact terms. Give us the specific parlor trick we require, and then we will grant you our intellectual compliance.
Right. And I have to pause right there because reading this, my first instinct is just to wonder why he doesn't simply give them what they want.
Well, sure, that's the natural question.
I mean, if someone is asking you for proof, isn't the most logical, efficient thing to just provide the proof? Like, why does Jesus refuse to just give them the proof they want? Wouldn't that solve everything?
Well, what's fascinating here is the underlying assumption in your question.
Okay, what do you mean?
It's the idea that more evidence automatically leads to belief. We tend to think of human beings as like rational calculators, right? Give us the data and we will just update our worldview.
Right, like a computer.
Exactly. But modern psychology, and specifically the concept of the backfire effect, tells us that the human brain doesn't actually work that way at all. Jesus understands that their demand isn't driven by a genuine lack of evidence. It's driven by a protective reflex.
A protective reflex against what, though?
Against losing their identity and their status.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. When we encounter information that threatens our deeply held beliefs, especially beliefs that give us power or social standing, the brain processes that contradictory information as a literal physical threat.
Like a survival thing.
Exactly. The amygdala fires up, the logical process centers in the prefrontal cortex shut down, and we go into this defensive crouch. You just cannot out-evidence a defensive brain.
So it's like someone demanding you prove the earth is round, but they set the rules so that you are not allowed to use satellite images, physics, or astronomy.
Right, exactly.
They've rooked the criteria of the debate so that no matter what evidence you actually provide, they have a built-in excuse to reject it. They aren't looking for proof, they are looking for a shield.
That is the perfect analogy. They are rigging the criteria, and Jesus sees right through it.
Yeah.
He just refuses to play a rigged game. So instead of offering them the parlor trick, he pivots entirely. He points backward to history to highlight a profound, incredibly insulting irony.
Insulting to the Pharisees, you mean?
Oh, massively. He essentially tells these religious elites that they are spiritually blinder than their most hated historical enemies.
Which is a brilliant, if highly confrontational, debate tactic. But, you know, if you are going to use history as your defense, you have to be very careful about the specific historical witnesses you call to the stand.
Definitely.
And Jesus picks two very specific ancient figures to make his point here, Jonah and Solomon. The document frames these as case studies in outsider openness.
Right. And we really need to define what outsider means in this context.
Go for it.
Jesus is pointing to Gentiles. And in the rigid socio-religious hierarchy of the first century, a Gentile wasn't just someone from another country.
Right, it was much heavier than that.
Yeah, to a Pharisee, a Gentile was someone considered ritually impure, completely cut off from divine truth, and essentially just a lost cause. So comparing a Pharisee to a Gentile was a massive insult.
Okay, so let's look at the first Gentile case study here, which is the story of Jonah. The text points out that Jonah is sent to Nineveh, which is the capital of Assyria,
Right.
and the Assyrians weren't just foreigners, they were the existential, terrifying enemy of Israel. But I'm struggling with this part of the argument.
How so?
Well, the text describes Jonah as a reluctant prophet who puts in absolutely zero effort. I mean, he performs no miracles. He just walks into this hostile pagan city and delivers a single grumpy sentence of doom.
Yeah, just 40 more days and Nineveh will be overthrown.
Exactly. That is the entirety of his message. No elaborate theology, no signs or wonders to back up his credentials. Just a guy shouting in the street.
Literally just a guy shouting.
So why on earth did they listen to him? If Jonah was quite literally the worst, least convincing prophet ever, and he provided zero empirical evidence to back up his claim, why did a brutal, hostile city believe him?
It seems wild, right?
Is this text just exaggerating the story to make a rhetorical point?
Well, no, the brevity is exactly the point. The text isn't hiding Jonah's lack of effort. It's highlighting it to draw a contrast.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, the Ninevites didn't have generations of scripture, they didn't have theological training, and they certainly didn't have a flashy miracle. But what they did have was openness.
Mm-hmm.
When confronted with a warning, even a poorly delivered one from a literal enemy, they didn't cross their arms and demand to see Jonah's resume or, you know, ask for a magic trick.
Right.
They evaluated the message itself, recognized their own moral corruption, and repented. They changed their entire way of life based on a microscopic amount of evidence.
Because they weren't burdened by the arrogance of thinking they already knew everything.
Exactly.
Okay, I see how that works. But here's where it gets really interesting. Jesus doesn't just stop with Jonah's minimal effort. He immediately pairs that story with the exact opposite end of the spectrum.
Right, he swings all the way to the other side.
Yeah, he brings up Solomon, and Solomon was Israel's wisest king, a figure of immense wealth and intellect. And the text says Solomon attracted the Queen of the South, historically known as the Queen of Sheba.
Another Gentile.
Yeah.
Another pagan outsider.
But her story is the total inverse of Nineveh's. She didn't have a grumpy prophet wander into her living room and hand her the truth.
Not at all.
She had to launch a massive expedition to find it. We're talking about a journey of roughly 1,500 miles across some of the most unforgiving desert terrain in the ancient world.
It's unbelievable.
This is months of grueling travel, bringing caravans of spices, gold, and precious stones, all just to hear Solomon's wisdom.
I mean, the sheer logistics of her journey are staggering, when you really think about it. The physical risk, the economic cost, the time away from ruling her own kingdom.
Yeah, a massive undertaking.
She put in an astronomical amount of personal effort and investment just for the opportunity to recognize Solomon's God-given insight. She wasn't handed a sign on a silver platter. She hunted for the truth at great personal cost.
And if we lay these two stories side by side, it creates this inescapable trap for the Pharisees.
It really does.
You have the Ninevites who responded to the absolute bare minimum of evidence with immediate humility. And then you have the Queen of Sheba, who expended immense painstaking effort to seek out wisdom.
Right.
Both were outsiders. Both were Gentiles. Both lacked the generations of specialized training the religious elite possessed. And yet, both of them recognized the truth.
Now bring that historical contrast into the present moment of the text. Contrast those open-minded outsiders with the religious leaders of Jesus' day.
The ultimate insiders.
Exactly. These leaders have the ultimate truth standing directly in front of them.
Yeah.
Jesus is performing healings, teaching complex theology, and fulfilling ancient texts. They have maximum evidence.
Yeah, it requires zero travel distance.
Exactly. The truth has literally walked up to them.
Yeah.
And yet they remain utterly blind, crossing their arms and demanding, "Give us a different sign. Give us the specific proof we want."
Wow. It is a devastating psychological takedown. But, you know, Jesus is still putting together a very specific puzzle here.
How so?
Well, he could have chosen any figures from history to make this point about outsiders, right? Like, he could have used the widow of Zarephath from the Elijah stories or Nem and the Syrian. Why pair Jonah and Solomon specifically?
Ah, that's a great question. It's because Jonah and Solomon represent two of the most critical structural pillars of Jesus's own claims.
Okay, unpack that.
Well, in the ancient Hebrew tradition, you have different avenues through which divine revelation arrives. You have prophecy, which is what Jonah represents.
Got it.
Prophecy is the warning of impending judgment and the urgent call to repentance. And then you have wisdom, which Solomon represents. Wisdom is the deep structural understanding of how the world works and how to live correctly within it.
Oh, I see. So he is using these two towering figures to establish the high watermark for both prophecy and wisdom. He's saying, look at the greatest examples of these two pillars.
Precisely. But he only establishes that baseline so he can entirely shatter it. The source document breaks down the almost mathematical nature of the claims Jesus is making here. For Jonah, the prophet who brought a simple warning of doom, Jesus claims to bring the ultimate salvation and resurrection.
Yeah.
And for Solomon, the mortal king who offered great earthly wisdom, Jesus claims to embody divine wisdom itself, literally the very kingdom of God.
So what does this all mean? How does this historical contrast actually apply to the way a modern student, or just the way we process information today? The source text refers to this as an argument from lesser to greater. Walk me through the actual mechanics of that logic.
Sure. If we connect this to the bigger picture, the logic works like a mathematical inequality.
Okay, let's hear the math.
Let's look at the variables. Variable A, the pagan Ninevites repented for a lesser, reluctant prophet who offered zero signs. Mm-hmm. Variable B, the pagan queen of Sheba, crossed the known world, risking her life and fortune for a lesser mortal king offering earthly wisdom.
Okay, track.
Therefore, the conclusion is inescapable. It absolutely defies logic that the religious insiders, you know, the supposed experts, are stubbornly ignoring the one who is infinitely greater than both Jonah and Solomon combined, especially when he is doing the work right in front of them.
Man, it totally strips away their defense that they just need a little more data. It exposes the fact that their demand for a sign is entirely in bad faith.
It forces anyone listening to interrogate their own motives. It challenges you to ask a very uncomfortable question.
Which is?
Is my skepticism actually just stubbornness masquerading as intellectual rigor?
Oof. That's good.
Am I genuinely waiting for more evidence? Or have I rigged the criteria so that I never have to change my mind? Because if the ancient outsiders could see the truth with a fraction of the data, the problem isn't the data. The problem is the receiver.
When you apply that to how we consume information today, it hits incredibly close to home.
Oh, absolutely.
Think about what happens when you are scrolling through a news feed and you see a scientific study or a piece of reporting that completely debunks your favorite political stance or challenges a deeply held personal belief.
Right. The walls go up.
Instantly. How often do you instantly become a hypercritical detective?
Yeah.
You look for a flaw in their methodology. You question the sample size. You attack the funding of the researchers. You demand impossible levels of absolute proof.
Yep.
But if a study pops up that agrees with what you already believe,
you don't even read the methodology. You just read the headline, feel validated, and share it immediately.
Exactly. We apply the Pharisees' weaponized skepticism to the things we hate, and we apply the Ninevites' immediate acceptance to the things we like.
That is so true.
We use the phrase, "I need to do more research," as a shield against uncomfortable truths. It's not about the evidence. It's about our willingness to let the evidence change us.
Perfectly said.
But this brings us to a critical pivot in the source material. Jesus completely dismantles their demand for a parlor trick. He exposes their bad faith, but he doesn't leave them with nothing. He actually does offer them a sign.
He does offer a sign, but it is entirely on his own terms.
Right.
It requires them to wait, and it requires them to watch. It's not the immediate gratification they're demanding. This leads us to the core concept of the document, the sign of Jonah.
And the document details this fascinating parallel. Jesus tells them, "A wicked and adulterous generation asks for a sign, but none will be given it except the sign of the prophet Jonah."
Right.
And then he explains how this ancient story maps onto his own future. Just as Jonah was in the belly of a huge fish for 3 days and three nights before being spat out onto dry land.
Essentially experiencing a type of resurrection so he could go save Nineveh.
Exactly. Jesus predicts his own trajectory using that. He says the Son of Man will be in the heart of the earth for 3 days and three nights before his own resurrection.
It is a stunning rhetorical pivot. They ask for a magic trick right now.
Yeah.
He promises them the ultimate historical event later.
Yeah.
He takes the story of Jonah, a text these scholars had memorized and studied their entire lives, and completely recontextualizes it. He turns a historical narrative about a fish into a preview of his own death and resurrection.
Wow.
The resurrection itself will be the final, undeniable sign of his authority.
But he doesn't just drop that theological bombshell and walk away. He follows it up with a consequence that must have sounded like absolute blasphemy to the Pharisees.
Oh, for sure.
The document highlights this as the threat of final judgment. Because the Ninevites and the Queen of the South responded correctly to the much dimmer, lesser revelations of Jonah and Solomon, Jesus says something incredibly provocative.
Yeah, he really goes there.
He states that these ancient pagan Gentiles will literally rise up at the final judgment to condemn the current generation of religious experts.
You really have to understand the worldview of a first-century Pharisee to grasp how offensive this was.
Right.
These Jewish leaders believed deeply that at the end of time, they would be the ones sitting in judgment over the corrupt pagan Gentiles.
Because they were the insiders.
Exactly. They were the chosen ones. And Jesus takes their entire cosmological courtroom and flips it upside down. He puts the religious elite on trial, and he makes the Ninevites and the Queen of Sheba the ultimate witnesses for the prosecution.
I am fascinated by that concept, the witnesses for the prosecution. But wait, what is the actual mechanism of their condemnation?
What do you mean?
Well, it can't be that the Ninevites or the Queen of Sheba were morally superior people. Assyria was a brutal empire, and Sheba was a pagan kingdom. So on what grounds are they condemning the Pharisees?
This raises an important question about the nature of judgment in this text.
Okay.
The logic these ancient figures will use at the final judgment has nothing to do with moral perfection.
Mm-hmm.
It is entirely about their response to the evidence they were given.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, the text points out that their very existence on the witness stand acts as an unanswerable indictment. Their testimony will essentially be, "We repented and believed with barely a fraction of the grace and the data you were given."
Wow.
"We had one angry guy shouting in the street, or we had to walk thousands of miles through a desert just to get a glimpse of wisdom. You had the Messiah healing people in your living room.
Yeah.
You had the truth handed to you, and yet you still refused to believe."
Their presence proves that the insider's unbelief is completely inexcusable. It proves that the evidence was always more than sufficient, if only they had possessed the humility to accept it.
Exactly.
It is such a rich, structurally brilliant argument. And it brings us to a place where we really have to synthesize everything we've unpacked today.
Sounds good.
We started by looking at how the source text of Matthew 12 uses the historical figures of Jonah and Solomon to construct a massive psychological contrast. A contrast between outsider openness, you know, the people who responded to minimal evidence or who were willing to put in immense effort, and insider blindness.
Right. The cultural elite who had everything handed to them but remained locked in their own weaponized skepticism.
Yeah. And we explored how Jesus utilized these specific figures to represent the foundational pillars of prophecy and wisdom, establishing the baseline just so he could demonstrate that he is the something greater that fulfills both.
Exactly. And we saw how he totally deconstructs the very nature of demanding a sign, exposing that when the criteria for proof are rigged, no amount of data will ever be enough.
Which brings this entirely out of the ancient world and directly into your life today.
Right, to the modern listener.
Exactly. When you are evaluating complex research, when you are confronted with opposing viewpoints that challenge your identity, or when you encounter information that makes you deeply uncomfortable, what is your default posture?
That's the real question.
Are you approaching that new information like the open-minded queen of the South, willing to do the hard, painful work of following the truth wherever it leads, regardless of your preconceptions? Or are you approaching it with the stubborn, impossible-to-satisfy demands of the religious insiders, sitting back with your arms crossed, demanding that reality prove itself to you on a silver platter?
It really is a mirror held up to our own intellectual honesty.
Mm-hmm.
And there's one final, somewhat haunting thought drawn directly from the end of the source material that we haven't fully explored yet.
Oh, what's it that?
It's a psychological implication that really lingers. The text implies that even the ultimate undeniable sign, the sign of Jonah, the literal resurrection itself, still will not be enough for those who stubbornly refuse to see.
Wait, really? Even someone rising from the dead wouldn't be enough to change their minds?
The structure of the argument suggests exactly that. It forces us to mull over a deeply uncomfortable truth about the human condition and the architecture of our own brains. When we are deeply entrenched in our biases, when our entire identity and social standing are wrapped up in being the insider who already knows everything,
mm-hmm.
is it possible that absolutely no amount of evidence, not even a man rising from the dead, can change a closed mind?
Yeah.
If the brain perceives belief as a threat to its survival, it will rationalize away a resurrection just as easily as it rationalized away a medical study.
That is a heavy but absolutely vital concept to leave on. It completely redefines what it means to be a seeker of truth. The challenge isn't just about finding the right data. It's about cultivating the kind of mind that is actually capable of receiving it.
Perfectly put.
Thanks for joining us on this deep dive, and we'll see you next time.